first meeting, if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself, just saying a little bit more about yourself than you would typically. Hi, I'm Commissioner Milton from Polk County.
I am the test case for the microphone, Commissioner Milton, Polk County, and I'm a clerk.
I am too. What's your birthday?
Chris Love with Group One Real Estate, representing Polk County.
Out of tender with Weber State University.
I am Nick Christensen with Davis County Economic Development.
Lisa Liberg, Salt Lake City Economic Development.
Susan Smith, Lubbock Parsons Staff.
Bob Dandoy, Horry City.
Karen Lane, West Valley City.
Ellen Hacker with Jordan Valley Water Conservancy District.
Susie Decker, Resilience Public Finance.
Andrew Barfield, Snowy's Resort.
Debbie Wynn, Twilla City Mayor.
Ty Bailey with Morgan City, but I'm originally from Idaho. My journey started in 1974.
She Utah in 1974?
No, that's what I was heard. That's what I was born, so you wanted to know a little bit more. Everybody else failed, so I thought I would make up the difference.
So way back.
So I'm Morgan City's longest tenured city manager, because I'm the first. So every day's a new record.
Really great. Thanks, guys.
You're welcome.
Mike, Marty County Council.
Ty's my hero.
I'm Andrew Berger with Wasatch Front Regional Council.
I'm Scott Hess with Wasatch Front Regional Council and the Wasatch Front Economic Development District.
We'll let you get situated, and then it's all you to introduce yourself. No, you're fine. Just push the button.
Rick Bowen, Associate Vice President of Workforce Economic Development, Salt Lake Community College.
Thanks, Rick. Those of you in the back, Denise, let's start with you.
Thank you, Denise. I'm a court of emergency staff. And I count the very first staff. For the very long time.
Ben Tracker, Science Code Finance.
Patrick Bowen, Utah Association of Counties.
I'm Troy, WFRC staff.
Ned Hacker, WFRC staff.
Mary Pratt, WFRC staff.
Mary. And she wanted to come to the table since you're going to be presenting here.
That was an order of things.
I'm going to come to the table, so we're not having to shuffle.
I already told Pat.
When we get here. Please, both of you. You're on the agenda, so I would.
I thought I'd be up for podium.
You could do podium too, but join us. So you're in the conversation. Okay, this is our time for public comment. Oh, sorry. Everyone got the minutes. Did anyone read the minutes? Great, thank you, Commissioner. Does anyone have any objectives to the minutes, or can I get a motion to approve the minutes from February 21st, which was our closed session, and March 25th, which was our last full board meeting? We can do those one at a time, or together.
I would second Ty's motion to approve.
To approve both of them?
Whatever he said.
Okay. We have a first and a second to approve both the February 21st minutes and the March 25th minutes. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All unanimous. All right. Item number 3 on your agenda is an opportunity for public comment. So if there's anyone from the public that wishes to speak, now is your time. Okay. Seeing none, we will close public comment. And again, just for the record, so everyone knows, this is being recorded and streamed live. Okay, item number 4 is an action item. We have been working, Scott mainly, has been working very hard on the 2018 to 2030 sets. He's going to walk us through everything that's been going on. He emailed this out 3 weeks ago.
It was a little over 4 weeks ago we received a Google Doc version of this that was the public hearing, and then about we had the final redesign document sent to you. So substance-wise, it was the same, but it's in its new form.
And we, so appreciate the people that did comment. They were great inputs, and we hope that this is now in its final stage, although Scott's going to walk us through it and make sure that we know everything we need to know about what's going to be submitted. Scott, I'll turn it to you.
Thank you. So I'm going to back up just a little bit and give some context for those who are new to the group. Some of you, March was your very first meeting, and we were at the end of a year-long process in developing a five-year plan. So the Comprehensive Economic Development Strategy is the primary work product for us as a group, the Wasatch Front Economic Development District, which is made up of two parties. There's a 12-member board, representation from five counties, Morgan, Tooele, Salt Lake, Davis, Weber counties, and then two at-large folks, one who's DWS and the other is the state GOMED. And then there's a 13-member strategy committee, which is private sector participants. And if you, when we get to that point, one thing that's missing in this document are both the members and the alternates. So if you don't see your name in the document, I apologize that we did just the member list, which is what we did back in 2014, and want to reflect the good work that the alternates did as well. So we're going to put the full list in of both committees in there. Let's have Susie pull up our annual goals. So at the beginning of this year, this committee put together annual objectives for 2019, one of which, the first one, and this you have a paper copy of as well on the desk, but the first goal being to complete, adopt, and report on the 2018-2023 Comprehensive Economic Development Strategy. It may feel a little weird to adopt a five-year program the second year in, but we actually received an extension from the Economic Development Administration from last September to retool this plan and also to align it with our Wasatch Choice 2050 Regional Vision and the 2019-2050 Regional Transportation Plan. So we're one of the few EDDs and metropolitan planning organizations across the country that has had the opportunity to align major transportation projects, economic development, and a regional vision for land use all together at the same time. So I think that we should count ourselves lucky in that and also look at the opportunities that those three plans coming together have in relation to one another. So first goal being complete report and adopt the SEDS. I'm happy to say that we have a SEDS and would like to just run through it a little bit with you. I know you've all read it twice for all the typos and errors. And the intent today, and substance, the intent today is to take your feedback, final feedback, and then ask for a motion to approve this to move forward to the Economic Development Administration with direction to our staff to make the discussed edits. So it's not closed book on this. This is final draft, but we can certainly take edits and comments today and we welcome those. But just due to timing, looking for a motion to approve the plan today, if you so move, and then get this off to the Economic Development Administration on June 1st. So with that context, we'll run through a little bit about the plan and what it has in it. So you should each have a paper copy in front of you. One thing we've shortened it. It's about 22 pages shorter than the previous SEDS. It was really a difficult process of taking information out. I think all of the information in the 2014 and then ongoing SEDS that we had prior was all really good stuff. So it was a difficult process to pare it down. And it's not quite as short as I think we promised you it would be last year, but that's just the nature of these sorts of regional documents. We don't have a true executive summary. The document is short enough that it basically is the executive summary at 50 pages with pictures, but there is a short preface, and on that first page outlines our four strategies. So the four key items that we're going to do for economic development in the region is link development with transportation and other infrastructure, create fiscally sustainable places, provide amenities, and attract and retain businesses and encourage innovation. And these should look familiar to you because back in March, we reviewed a rather large 11 by 17 spreadsheet that had these four strategies, as well as objectives, actions, and performance measures, which are written into this plan. Quick introduction. I did notice that we are missing the alternate, so we'll put that together. And I would welcome any feedback as we're running through this. I was planning on taking just 5 or 10 minutes and going through this and kind of front back so you know what's in it. And then we can have a roundtable discussion and open it up for discussion. But if there are questions as we go through, please feel free to bring those up.
Yeah, I'm just going to make one comment, Scott. If you actually go back to the preface, which lists those four key strategies as on page five, again, this should be familiar to you because we've been working as a group and talking about these priorities. And I just want to note, the work that Wasatch Front Regional Council does is focused on planning for transportation and land use, the integration of where people live and where they work and how they get around. And those kinds of strategies are really the elements of the first, second, and third. Linking our development decisions with transportation and other infrastructure, creating places that are fiscally sustainable over time so we can have a balance of household expenses as well as public tax revenue, and then also providing amenities, having quality of life in our neighborhoods and our communities, no one size fits all, but overall quality of life. And the basic notion here is that by having those things happen, having good, high quality of life communities, good transportation, good housing, that in of itself, that provides the conditions in which economic development can thrive. The last one, attract and retain businesses and encourage innovation, is kind of a catch-all where you would find, and we'll find as Scott goes through this, all of the strategies, the much broader range of strategies employed by, at the state level, by GOED, or EDCU, or the county economic development, or city economic development, because the work of the EDD, this group, is not meant to replace or supplement or contradict with the work of all the other really good economic development activities. It's meant to supplement and tie in. And what that fourth goal does is it essentially captures all of those broad activities that are in play in the region to promote economic development. So I just wanted to thanks for letting me interject with just a little bit of broad context on the overall approach.
Perfect. Thank you. Starting on page 9, you have the regional vision. And going back to 2016, Wasatch Front Regional Council adopted 10 goals. And those 10 goals are much broader than transportation alone or economic development alone. They're really quality of life goals and get to what we as a council, the region, five county area, wants to inform and impact. And you can think about Wasatch Choice 2050 10 goals sit as an umbrella over the top of our regional transportation plan, on top of our comprehensive economic development strategy, and on top of the efforts that we do with local land use. So really this is 10 goals bolstered by four strategies and how we feel that they impact them. So this is the quick snip of basically how economic development operates within the regional context of the goals. And again, just because they're that important, the next page, page 11 is our core strategy. So it's real clear what we're working with. The former sets had six goals, and it had morphed over time to having a three strategy plan that was similar to these. So we actually took two working documents of the EDD, the original SEDS, and this strategy's goal, and kind of brought the two together to align the SEDS with what I think the EDD was actually working on. So hopefully this is, you know, relates directly to the work we have, as well as meets EDA's requirements for getting EDA funding into local communities based on your projects and your priorities. Page 13, this is the background. This is one area that we did slim down a little bit. If you didn't catch it, it's not tied together as well as we could in some ways, but each of the infographics relates back to one of the headings in the summary background. So this is the data that Bench Becker presented to us from Zions Public Finance. So the summary background and the infographics are all directly related to information that you have heard. And instead of having each individual county have a one-page write-up and then infographics, we basically hit the region as a whole and then focus directly on the data. So if you see any holes in this or inconsistencies or issues, this is one area where I think that additional feedback and comment would be real beneficial. But again, we were trying to keep the document pretty tight to focus on the region and specifically the data. So some catalyst projects, which are just major projects across the region. And then it starts with regional data and then goes through each county one by one. If you notice, starting on page 19, there's...
Wait, slow down just for one second.
So, and I appreciate because you're trying to get through a lot here. So, starting on page 16, what Scott's saying, and I know all of you have looked at this in detail already, just to make sure. On page 16, you'll see data for the entire region. Okay? Data, infographics, and then a chart that shows information about anticipated job increases and the square footage needed for those jobs. And again, this is work that Zions Bank Public Finance did. So it has it for the whole region, and then it goes county by county, the same data, but for each county. So you can look at your county and zoom in on how that information is relates to your area and then differs to the region as a whole or for other counties. Okay. And then there are specific strategies that are identified for each county as well.
Yeah. And those, the specific counties that were identified, I reached out to a member of the EDD for each county, and time was pretty tight, so I actually received two back, but there were some of these that I went out online and looked up information for, and I've already, Morgan County, for instance, we've had a discussion about some changes or amendments if they want there. So double check your county's strategic initiatives. We don't have a ton of room. We could expand this a little bit, but we just wanted it to be a quick hit of what the county is focusing on, maybe how it relates back to the SEDS, but really just give you a voice in the document to be able to say what your county is focused on specifically. I don't know if there's any questions, but Ben just here to field any questions on the data too. If you have any on the infographics, we can go through those. Page 29 is our strength, weakness, opportunity, threat analysis. Are there any questions to that point?
I know that.
So beginning on page 29, the SWOT analysis is a requirement of the SEDS. This is some new data, some of the data that came from 2017 and 2018 as we were doing our previous work. One thing to note, when we talked about this in the write-up, is that transportation infrastructure ended up in all four of the items. It's a strength, weakness, opportunity, and threat. When you tease the data out a little bit and it goes into the self-selected questions and some of the answers there. Today, transportation infrastructure is a strength. We have really good mobility across the region, but it could be a perceived weakness if we don't continue to invest in it. It's an opportunity for some of the new projects that are coming in, but again, it's a threat to our air quality and our general mobility getting goods moved around if we don't continue to invest. So some of these items are a little bit more nuanced than just the words on the page, and we try to reflect that back in the write-up.
And then you just think transportation is really important, so if you wanted to reflect
it, I just want to reflect it, yeah. I'm not a transportation planner. So. And then page 31, this is the meat of the document, the performance, plan of action, and performance evaluation. So we've got those four strategies.
Which we went through in detail in the last meeting.
Correct. So this is really the data from the previous that we went through together. You all made amendments too, and then you sent me additional comments, and those should be reflected in here now. So this is updated. But we have the strategy. So strategy one has four key objectives. The next page has those objectives and the actions that we will undertake as both a region. It could be the EDD, Wasatch Front Regional Council, state partners, local partners, EDCU, GOED, other folks. So we've tried to refer back to who would be the action item. And as we look at moving forward and how this relates to our annual objectives, I think the work in strategy one is the first thing that we're going to undertake over this next year. So this is our core work that we as an EDD can inform. The other goals in some ways are more about partnerships and capturing economic development work at a regional level that's happening across multiple organizations. But I think that this is the meat of the work that we're going to come back in our August meeting and have a real plan of action about what we're doing, reports back on the information that we gather to begin actually implementing this plan. So there's basically three pages. So strategy one, the objectives, actions, and then if you flip that over on page 34 is strategy one's performance evaluation measures, a responsible party, and a time frame. So these are a little bit, they're not fully fleshed out. There's information information that could be added to this, but we do an annual report back to EDA. So as you read this, we will do a report about this time next year on the work that we've done, performance measures that we've reported on, and we'll send that, we'll review you and then send it back to EDA and update this plan. So the hope is that those collaborative actions and maybe some of the performance measures get refined, but that the actions actually fall off and we have new actions over the next year that we're beginning to work on. And then it repeats for strategy 2, 3, and 4 as you go through this plan. Any questions there? And then item 6 is economic resilience. So one of the economic resiliency is a required section for SEDS. There's been some direction in the last few years to actually write economic resilience directly into the SEDS. So instead of it being its own chapter, it's actually referred to throughout your strategy. So if you read the strategies, there's it will refer to how things are creating a more resilient economy in our region. And I think that it's a little bit difficult in Utah because we already have such a resilient economy to just state the obvious or to say that we have one of the most diverse economies across the nation here and that builds our resilience. So we still want to keep this section, but I can see over time this section becoming slimmer and actually more of this information just being directly input throughout the whole document itself. But want to make sure that we meet EDA requirements and also just inform what we're doing for resiliency. On the last page 51, the appendix section. So we're currently gathering up the appendix information, and the items that will be in that will be the full list of data tables from Zions Public Finance is one of the appendix, our public comment posting period, the public comments that we've received. So just gathered information and resources as we develop the plan that we haven't, I mean, they're all combined, but in different files. So those will be rolled into this prior to being sent off to EDA at the end of the month. And that's my quick overview of the SEDS, and would love to have a little discussion and answer any questions you all have.
So let's start there. Any thoughts, questions? Anything you'd like to clarify that you've seen that didn't get put in?
Mr. Chairperson. I see a lot in this document that basically talks about local government involvement. And surely we do have our own economic development efforts. How do you see then those things that we're doing locally being then tied into this overarching document?
We don't own any land. We're not reaching out to businesses. We're not creating the tax incentive structures. So I think that a lot of implementation of a regional strategy relates to the local communities adopting a regional vision and then working towards it. So I think that you're the bread and butter, you're the wheels on the ground of moving this forward. So if we incorrectly referenced this of work that you would do at a local level that would implement a regional strategy, then I'd love to have that conversation. So I hope that it's reflective of work that you, one, are probably already doing, but two, can see how it will reflect back up and inform and implement the regional vision.
And I guess for that point, Scott, actually it fits very nicely in terms of at least how Roy's looking at it. So I don't see a problem. I guess the key would be is, do you see any mechanism that you would ask us then to kind of help report up to you in this case to basically share how we're now implementing many of the things you're talking about that? Is that pretty how you see the integration?
That's all reflected in item number 4. You're exactly right, Mayor. I mean, this is, we're adopting the SED, but the real work is outside of these doors and outside of this document. And you can see the responsible parties throughout this document. It's a lot falls within staff, but most of it is at the ground level, the local governments, you know, working to continue to have a robust economic development strategy and then execute on that. So absolutely, we want to have this mechanism as a sharing too. You know, what you're doing on Main Street in Roy should be part of our conversation and what other people can learn from that. So absolutely.
And comment on that also just briefly. I think Mayor Roy is a great example of this. So as a lot of people here know, the folks in Roy and Mayor Dandoy at the leading pack is looking at redevelopment of the area around the Roy Front Runner Station and also in downtown Roy, and thinking about ways that, I mean, you can tell the story a lot better than I can, but thinking about ways that you can redevelop and take advantage of the transportation infrastructure that's there to bring in more jobs and a mix of housing, et cetera. Those are some of the strategies that are articulated here. It's what you do at the local level that is principally going to drive that, but then there's also tying that in with regional transportation infrastructure. And so if there are ways that from a regional or a state level, we can help to make sure that the Front Runner service is as good as it can be, it comes frequently, it runs reliably, et cetera, that is going to help you at the local level because you're doing your redevelopment of your area. So that's why I feel like there's a, as Scott and Abby were saying, there's a local tie to the regional, that, you know, to the county, to the regional, and to the state level, all just working together.
Another way to look at this is that the SEDS is one federally required document that helps us to get, collectively, to get EDA funding. So you want to be able to look at the items in the SEDS, the strategies, the objectives, and the actions, and think at a local level, I need additional broadband service here, or I need a road to service this particular employer over here, and see yourself and your project in the SEDS in a strong enough tie that you can then apply to EDA, and we are the conduit for you to receive those funds. So that's why in some ways this is much more comprehensive than just us around the table can impact. And it's one of the very first reviews that we received back at the beginning of the year when we sent our first draft of strategies and objectives to EDA, was that it wasn't comprehensive enough. They were concerned that it might have limited what the local governments could apply for. So we opened it up, we made it a little bit more broad. So hopefully there are items that you see yourself with needs that you could apply to EDA funds in addition to the other federal resources and state dollars that we impact locally.
Any other questions? Thanks, Mayor, for that. Okay. Well, if there are none, I am going to entertain a motion to adopt. So we are going to give Scott an applause after this for all his work here. But before we do that, we are going to adopt the SEDS. So staff can go ahead and execute on turning it in before June 1st to the EDA.
Just one technical thing. Can we request that motion allow staff to make some modest technical adjustments if there's some little cleanup items that we need to take?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
So moved. Let's say modifications suggested.
Okay. I'm sorry, who seconded it? Hi, Gaydon.
Second by Mike View.
Thank you both. All those in favor of adopting the SEDS with minor modifications from staff before turn in on June 1st, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. And Scott has done a tremendous amount of work on this. Obviously, he described how we had our first crack at this, and they asked us to go back to the drawing board and put a little more meat on the bone. So he and staff deserve a lot of credit for this. So if you'll just join me in thanking him for everything. Are you bowing?
No, I'm going to leave. I'm just going to walk out.
Oh. Drop the mic and leave. I didn't know if you were bowing.
No.
We certainly can if we want to stick here.
I just wanted to say one more thing, and that is for Scott and the rest of the staff here. We don't look at adopting the SEDS as the, you know, end. Like, we're not, I mean, yes, Scott deserves a round of applause, but is actually the start now of another round of actually moving forward. And one of the reasons that we really focused in this document on what the strategies are and then what the actions that need to be taken and performance measures is because we want, everybody has to be involved in actually doing stuff at the local level, at the county level, you know, and what works for in each of your counties and cities to actually get this done. So, if we're doing our job right, then you're going to be hearing from us and feeling a slight pressure about, hey, remember that strategy we adopted, how it has an action? Well, that applies to the universities, or that applies to the county, or that applies to the city. And, you know, what are you doing on this? How can we help you with this and pushing this forward to get these things done? And again, none of it should be any surprise to any of you.
it's all logical strategies, but they take effort and collaboration. So look for more on this as we go forward.
Thank you. And it really, it's not my plan. This is all of our plans. So thank you all for staying engaged and being with us through this process and helping me to write this and put it together, because I couldn't have done it without everybody. Thank you.
Wonderful. Okay, let's move on to item number 5, and that is a discussion on opportunity zones. We're joined by Patrick Mullen. He's going to take the podium now. And oh, before you get started, Patrick, I totally failed to mention this. Our co-chair, Commissioner Farr, and many of the local elected officials on this board are actually at a conference, a retail conference.
ICSC, International Conference of Shopping Centers. Right, yeah. Financials are not.
Shopping centers are not in the sets, I will tell you that. Just kidding.
And can I just say that opportunity zones are strategy 2, objective 4, increasing financial literacy about innovative financing strategies and incentive policies. And there's a collaborative action to focus our efforts in opportunity zones and Wasatch Choice 2050 centers.
That's a great segue.
What a segue. Can you hear me through this?
Yeah.
I also want to say I'd rather be at the International Shopping Center Convention. Sounds interesting. But no, thank you for the kind introduction and the nice segue. For those of you I haven't met, I see a lot of familiar faces, but some new ones. I'm Patrick Mullen. I'm with an organization called the Utah Association of Counties. And we were one of the organizations selected as part of a coalition to manage the state of Utah's opportunity zone marketplace creation. It was a contract from the Governor's Office of Economic Development. Before I get into my quick presentation here, I'll just preface this by saying I'd love to make this a lot more interactive. I've got some slides to walk us through this, but anytime you have a question or if you want to jump into a topic, opportunity zones can be a pretty broad thing, so I'd love to open it up to be more of a discussion. And I'll also give you some background on myself. So I come from the world of private finance. I used to be the executive director of a firm called Sorensen Impact. There, I was lucky enough to work with the firm's founder very closely, Jim Sorensen, who obviously is a very prominent entrepreneur and philanthropist here in Utah. And among helping build his global portfolio of private investments that he calls impact investments, or things that help communities where they were located across the globe, we took a variety of policy issues, and I was lucky enough to participate in those conversations at the national level, ranging from everything from reforming the way foundations make for-profit investments but still remain aligned with the IRS's tax policies. And we actually stumbled across opportunity zones pretty early on, going back almost 3 or 4 years ago, when a group called the Economic Innovation Group, which is a Washington, D.C. think tank that wrote the bill. They were founded by Sean Parker of Facebook and Napster fame, of all people. They were looking at this map, and they were basically saying, what is behind this rise of economic distress across America? 52 million Americans live in economically distressed communities. The original hypothesis when they started looking at this, post-2008 Great Recession, was that, sure, our capital market cities are now booming post-recession. So the San Franciscos, the New Yorks, the Bostons, they're experiencing tremendous growth. They thought the rest of the country would probably be just lagging behind. It's growing, but not at the same rate. And what they found was pretty astounding. A lot of these communities, they weren't just not growing at the same rate, they were declining. They were losing jobs, they were losing people, people were moving. And among the very many reasons that were behind this, a common theme that emerged was access to capital. Right? There wasn't an incentive for investors to be looking at overlooked markets, whether they were urban or rural, and that got the wheels turning around. Well, how could you create an incentive to bring private capital to underlooked urban and rural communities? That incentive eventually turned into what is now known as opportunity zones. It was a bipartisan supported bill. It was both sides of the aisle politically really got behind it early on. The issue was that in our previous presidential administration, Congress wasn't really passing a lot of bills at the time. So it wasn't that this encountered resistance. It was just that the legislative process didn't allow for it to happen. We actually kind of thought for a moment that it had kind of, we've lost all hope in early 2017. And then all of a sudden with President Trump's Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, Senator Hatch from Utah at the time, Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina, and Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey played a really large role in getting this thrown into the bill, and all of a sudden it became reality.
And so, for those of you that don't know, I'll refresh on this very quickly. What opportunity zones provide to the private capital that is out there is they say if you take your capital from a capital gains event, so if you have a building that you're selling as an example, or a portfolio of stocks that you're realizing a sale on, you have to pay capital gains taxes on that typically. But they say if you take those taxes and you put them into a newly formed fund that will invest in newly designated opportunity zones, you immediately defer the capital gains tax that you have on that. If you stay in the fund for 5 years, if it's invested in these projects, you get a 10-point step up in basis, or essentially a 10% discount. If you stay for 7 years, that 10 points moves to 15. But the real kicker is if you stay for 10 years, you'll have only paid that deferred gain less the discount that you received. But any new gain that you have, let's say you turned around and put $1 million, as an example, into building a new building in one of these zones, if 10 years from now that building is worth 10, your new $9 million gain, you pay zero capital gains taxes on. So it's quickly got the attention of real estate investors, of private equity investors, of really a whole range of folks who are now looking at these newly formed zones, saying, how do we begin to put private capital towards improving some of these communities and investing in interesting projects? Here in Utah, we have 46 zones. The way the selection process was done, I'm sure many of you will know this, was in partnership with your AOG organization, so WFRC led out for this regions. And in the federal bill, it mandated that the governors of every state have the ability to nominate 25% of the low-income census tracts in their state as opportunity zones. Nationwide, there's over 8,700 of these zones. In Utah, there were 181 eligible census tracts. That meant that Governor Herbert could pick 46. And we ended up with a pretty, I would say, even balance across urban and rural. Obviously, Salt Lake, being both the business and population capital of the state, got the majority. They have 15. Weber, Utah, and Davis then make up another 13, 5 across Weber and Utah, and 3 in Davis. And then you've got a mix across the rest of the non-Wasatch Front parts of the state. And you might be looking at this map saying, why does it look like rural Utah has way more zones than urban Utah? It's because of the census tracts in rural communities. In some cases, there's only 2 or 1 in some of these counties. So in Grand County, as an example, which is the easternmost zone on our map, the little white dot that's not included is actually most of the Main Street of Moab, the city proper of Moab. The remaining part of the county is 1 census tract, and so that was the census tract that Grand County ended up nominating, and it was ultimately selected by Governor Herbert. These zones are now written into national law along with the other 8,700, so there's no moving them, there's no adjusting them, there's no going back and saying, hey, we think we may have made a mistake here, we move it to this region. They're very hard and firm. And to give you an example, one of the zones in Box Elder includes Brigham City. Half of Brigham City on this side of the street is in, on the other side of the street is out. The barrier runs right down the street, and there is no stretching. On the side that's out, it is out. That's one of the more common questions that I get around what do these zones mean and how do we use them. You might be asking,
Patrick, just before you move on, just a quick note for Council Member Newton and for Ty, who may be wondering, where's Morgan County? The reason you're not on that list, there's no low-income census tracts in Morgan County. So, good with the bad? I don't know, depending on your perspective in this conversation, but that's the explanation.
Well, it correlates with every decision that's made is based on median income and not earnable wage.
Yeah.
And so, it's just backwards on a lot of different areas. But you got to use an indicator of something, right?
Whenever yeah.
you go to a sewer project or anything else, it's like, well, you've got a high median income, even though we've only got 4,500 people. And the average wage that you can earn living in Morgan is lower than
yeah.
in other areas.
This is a common question, I'd say, nationwide. A lot of folks have said census tracts probably are not the best way to do this, and looking at the federal indicators of what really means what low income is doesn't encapsulate real world scenarios. I think unfortunately when you're dealing with a nationwide mandate, they felt that this was the most logical way to do it, but I would certainly agree with you. I think it unfortunately, even in some counties where they have a zone, I commonly hear from people there, they say, who drew this map? Like, I know this area was eligible, but it's really weird. It doesn't follow our business district. It doesn't even follow our streets in some cases. And that's because we're stuck using the census tract and using these federal indicators of low income. So it's It's not perfect by any means. I think nobody would say that. What we are left with, though, is pretty hard set boundaries.
I was wondering why San Juan County is.
San Juan, that's actually part of Navajo Nation as well. So Navajo Nation has...
I'll let them know.
So the census is coming up and boundaries will be redrawn. So is the federal law written such that if the opportunity zone follows the new boundaries, or will there be a lag time of prior boundary, new boundary based on the census, and then moving forward?
No, so not at this time. So the map that we have set now is set. And even though the census tracts may change, there's no indication at this time that they'll move the boundaries of what we have now. There may be, so right now the way the program is written is it passed, as I mentioned, in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. The program lasts for 10 years. So there's the potential that they renew the program, or there's the potential that they come back and maybe open it up for comments saying the census tracts have changed. We want to figure out if communities think these zones are in the right place. The flip side to that is there's over 8,000 nationally, so you're kind of opening Pandora's box if you allow anyone to change it. They're actually, and this has been publicly stated, so I'm comfortable restating it, in the southeastern part of our state, there was an error that was made with one of the zones. The northern part of San Juan County was actually supposed to be included, and there was literally just a clerical error in typing in the wrong zone, or wrong census tract, I should say. And unfortunately, nobody noticed, including at every step in the process, the AOG, the governor's office. It got submitted. It then was ratified by Treasury and written into law. And then everyone realized, wait a minute, we made a mistake. Senator Romney got involved. Everyone went and tried to change it. There's no changing it. So even at that scenario, I can't predict what Congress is going to do. If I could, I'd be in a different line of work. But that question of what's going to happen when the census boundaries is being redrawn is a hot topic at the nationwide level. Right now, it's been pretty firm. These zones are set. We're not going to change them. We're not going to move them.
There's one other thing.
Chris, will you talk into this?
Potential fly in the ointment. Specifically, while the legislation is passed, the rulemaking part from IRS and Treasury has not.
Yeah.
We're running up against a hard statutory deadline end of December, I think, where all of a sudden, if we don't have those rules in place, the 10-year part of it goes away. Because that can't fit within the time frame of the statute.
That part's not true. So what you're hitting on...
I just spent a week with Congressman Stewart talking about this very thing. We go ahead.
Yeah, no, but the 10-year piece is incorrect. What you're hitting up on is the latest the IRS will let you defer that initial gain is December 31st, 2026. So in order to get the 5 and 7 year step up in basis, you'd have to be invested by the end of 2019, where you're going to be closer than 7 years. Okay. However, the 10-year component holds for the life of the program. And the program runs through the end of 2027.
That was my question, making sure that the Treasury part of the rulemaking does include that.
So to give you an example, though, just to clarify your question, if you make an investment, let's say in 2025, right, you're way down the road, you're only a year away from when the IRS will allow you to defer that gain until. It's impossible for you to be in the fund for 5 years or 7 years to get the step up in basis. So you would defer your gain for a year, you'd get no step up, you'd have to pay the deferred gain in full. But if you stayed in your investment until 2035, you'd pay no new tax on your new capital gain. So the 10-year piece holds through the life of the program. Does that make sense?
That's a key clarification. The second part of my question goes to that very thing. Is UAC, for example, as an entity, whatever national organization you're part of, doing anything to lean on IRS to get that stuff done prior to the end of this year so that they can take full advantage of all of those things?
So we had a pretty sizable dump of new regulations about a month ago that clarified a lot.
That's a great word.
This is such a broad incentive. You're probably never going to have the playbook spelled out in black and white, right? But there was a number of outstanding questions that there were open comment periods on for about 6 months that Treasury finally issued those regulations. I actually have a slide on it about a month ago. I'm on the nationwide coalition with the Economic Innovation Group that's providing feedback in real time to exactly these things. The clock that's ticking is really on the 7-year holding period to where you would get that additional 5-point step up in basis. I think the good news is that from what I've heard in the investment community, while you want to maximize the incentive to the fullest extent, if you miss a 5-point step up in basis, that's probably the most minimal blow you have for your investment. The real reason you're excited about this is about the 10-year window. And the good news is that holds for the life of the program. So you have all the way through 2027 to have that incentive be there for you. What they did clarify, just to get to your point, a lot of people ask, what is this for? I think mistakenly, a lot of people think this is simply a real estate incentive. It's not. You'll probably see the majority of capital flow to real estates because it's logistically an easier way to structure within this. But because of the holding period, it only favors equity investments, right? So you can layer on project finance and debt. It doesn't get the incentive, but it can help your project. Only the equity is involved. You have to invest in qualified opportunity zone property. So dumbing that down, that essentially means you can invest in real business property. So if you're going to do that, you've got to pass one of two tests, right? It's either the original use test, where your fund's original use coincides with building something that wasn't there previously, or it's the substantial improvement test. So if you're going to buy a structure, you're an investor, and I'm going to come to one of these zones, and let's say Weber County in downtown Ogden, I'm going to buy a building. Then if you buy that building, you've got to substantially improve it. And substantially improve means investing an amount equal to the building's value. You can take the land out, but equal to the building's value in the first 30 months or 2.5 years. Because what they want to incentivize investors to do is they say, look, if you're going to come in and do this, it's got to be community development, and it's got to be oriented towards helping these communities. So if you know that there's a parking garage in downtown Ogden that's never going to leave, and you're just purely doing this for the tax arbitration play, they won't let you do that, right? You can't just buy a building and hold it.
No.
I mean, well, substantial improvement means, again, the building's value. So it's usually quite a bit. You can also buy stock or ownership in an operating business. And one of the areas that really hemmed up the investors on the operating business side initially was the way that a qualified opportunity zone business was defined. It was not only being located within the zone, but then having substantially all of their tangible assets in the zone, which was defined as 70%. And then they'd say, you have to do over 51% of your revenue from activity that occurs within the zones. And the business investment community said, well, wait a minute. What happens if we're investing in a tech startup that's selling to customers all over the world? How do we define what that 51% revenue test is? And so it led to a lot of folks saying, this is not as well thought out of as it should have been from the start. We need clarification from Treasury and from the rulemakers. And luckily, they came out with a series of fixes, I'll say. So on that 51% revenue test, they said, we hear you. We'll give you a menu to pass that test now. It can still be 51% of your revenue, or it could be 51% of your employees' time is spent within the zone, or 51% of the services that you perform that go to your revenue happen within the zone. And they even added another thing on that said, or you can kind of make your best case. So they're trying to make this as deliberately broad as they can, because they want to see a lot of many different types of investments come into this. I titled this slide eligible. That's probably misleading. I would say this is more like example investments, right? So high growth startups that are located in your zones are eligible. Main street businesses, the ones that easily pass those tests, right? The butcher maker, candlestick makers that are out there. Real estate is where the vast majority of investments are going now. And within real estate, I've seen a lot in the kind of high density, multi-use housing developments. We actually have one in Salt Lake, not too far from here, the Paper Box Lofts, which was done by a group called PEG down in Provo Property Enhancement Group. You're seeing a lot of hospitality investing as well, so hotels, things like that. You could potentially see manufacturing be done, commercial spaces, industrial is another hot issue, although you run into some leasing restrictions. But you can also do some asset-based investing. So a lot of solar development is happening using this incentive, a lot of infrastructure around rural broadband and telecom. I've even seen some really innovative approaches to doing things like brownfield redevelopment, co-working spaces, some real interesting affordable housing plays. So this slide and this takeaway is to say, it's a great incentive to the private sector, but it is just that, right? There's not federal dollars that come with this. There's not a nationwide U.S. government-led opportunity zone fund that you apply to. This is designed to bring in private capital to finance these types of things. And so what our role is at...
Sorry, go ahead. Yeah. Question. One of the... in transportation, and then also in multifamily mixed-use development, one of the barriers often is parking and structured parking, parking garages, because you can have it, and there's probably a lot of folks in this room that know more about this than I do, but in order to get a multifamily mixed-use development to happen, you have to provide structured parking to have the support the densities, but then the cost of the structured parking is too high and then the project doesn't pencil. So question, I guess, would a parking structure be an eligible investment for in an opportunity zone? I mean, if it doesn't exist, you're building it out, or does it have to be tied into the rest of the development? I mean, what do you think?
No, I mean, so if you wanted to build a parking garage from scratch, and then that parking garage was operated by a qualified opportunity zone business who could pass that test, right? Where there'd be almost no assets, right? The garage would be the asset. But then you say, well, 100% of our employees' time is going to be spent in the zone because our employees are going to be working the booth, then they would be an eligible company.
I guess what I'm getting at more is if a developer is going to build the housing and then also the, you know, the amenities, the parks, trails, whatever, but they can't make the parking garage element work financially, Benjamin, Susie can help me out here if I need it, but then if you can use the tax benefit from this to say, oh, well, that makes it pencil, we're going to put the parking, we're going to include the parking garage in as part of the development, and then the cost of that parking garage, you're not going to have to pay the capital gains on that, so it just makes it work. Does that make sense?
You'd have to find the investor that's willing to do that, though.
Yeah.
So what gives me pause is when you say it doesn't economically pencil, who is the person coming up with their own capital gains dollars that says, I'm going to put it to a project that doesn't pencil otherwise, right? Because this is a nice, it could work. I'd love your thoughts, Benjamin and Susie.
Sure, that's a good question. I think what we're hearing, and we look at it from a highest and best use perspective, that what may not have been feasible previously, so say a five-story multifamily residential development with a two-story parking garage, because it didn't pencil, now because of these tax savings, you are seeing investors saying, hey, we're looking at a 3-5% increase in IRRs based on the tax savings. We can now make this pencil.
Yeah.
So yes, this is now, it's a whole different highest and best use consideration. We've seen this in 10 different sites throughout the state where now investors are returning to projects and saying, it now pencils because of the tax savings. So.
Or it reduces the demand on tax increment or public incentive to go with it as well, because we've come so much closer and it makes things feasible with a little bit of help, for example, law that the city may want to have happen that weren't possible.
Right. Yeah, I will say there's a fund that I have been talking to that's looking at a project in Connecticut, actually in one of their zones right now, that's going through this right now. And they're willing to look at it to an extent. I think you hit on it, right? It's 2-3% below our baseline. That's about as far as we'll go. So the only reason I pause when you ask that is I don't, because a lot of community leaders say, hey, we've had a need to build, a parking garage, but nobody can make the numbers work. It's right. Got to be almost like funded by grant capital. Opportunity zones is not that. It's an incentive to an investment, right? And you've got to have an investment that, even with the tax incentive, pencils at the end of the day. So it's a question of who the investor is, but I think their points are spot on. You've got people taking a look at projects they otherwise would have not done before and willing to look at it in a different range of returns and risk appetites.
Right.
Blake?
Earlier you talked about kind of the difference from other federal programs where there isn't the funding. Can you talk about the relationship with the market tax credits and what opportunity zones mean?
Yeah, there's actually a lot of opportunity zone funds are using NNTCs in some of the deals that they have. And that's what's nice about the incentive is that you can layer different things onto it. So particularly on the housing development side, I've known of several funds that are using that to come in and almost create some free cash that could go into helping the project pencil out even further. So when you get into layering those types of things, and then I think Susie brought up the point that you maybe don't have to rely on TIF to the same level that you used to have to do it. You don't have to rely on going for other types of capital that you had before. It really opens up the realm of it. So I would say new market tax credits are actually playing a pretty large role at the nationwide level for this.
Great, thanks.
I'll quickly just hit on our project. We could spend long time on this, and I think I was only given 15 minutes on all this stuff. But what UAC specifically is doing is, you know, because of the work I had done with Jim Sorensen and his center previously, I was talking to the folks at GoEd about a year ago and asking, well, what's the state going to do around this? And they mentioned the need to have a consultant go out and help kind of build a marketplace on this. And we looked at kind of two distinct issues that were out there. Sorensen Impact, with its nationwide focus and obviously the network that Jim brings, kind of brought the opportunity zone expertise, brought the relationship with these funds across the nation that are saying, look, we know that Jim played a huge role in this. What's happening in Utah? Can you show us some of these eligible investments? Can you help build the state up? And the issue that Sorensen had was, we can certainly bring that side of the equation to the table. We don't really know the first thing about what's happening in all of your communities jurisdictionally. Whereas UAC was actually talking to a lot of their county commissioners and their county economic development team who were calling them and saying, we just got a zone. We worked with our association of government to get it. We don't know what this means. Can you help answer our questions? And they were saying, well, we don't know where to send them. And so by bringing them together and partnering up with the Gardner Policy Institute, we've kind of created a coalition, if you will, that's going to, you know, GoEd's mandate, I will be clear, is for non-Wasatch Front counties. They wanted to see this be used to the truest sense of the intent of the law, which is to help the overlooked and harder to reach areas. But because I now sit at UAC, my role is both managing the GoEd contract, but as the UAC employee, we count all of our Wasatch Front counties as of now as members, and we can certainly work with you in that. And it's to do both community engagement, right? So education, awareness, working to kind of talk about what these zones are, preparing market research and investment materials. So we're building prospectuses for every single county in the state and actually working on some of the individual deals that have cropped up to build summary sheets. And then marketing and providing investor communications to not only a statewide but a national audience to say, here's Utah, here's the projects that we have. And so we're about a week or so away. We've got kind of our screenshots of the sample prospectuses that are up here, as well as the sample deal briefs that we've put together. And we'll be launching the State of Utah's Opportunity Zones website here very shortly so that you can go in and see a heat map of the state, not only get an overview of the zones and the counties that they're in, but then see eligible projects and begin to drive up some of the investor interest that way. This is something that other states across the country are doing. I think we recognize that despite all of our tremendous resources in Utah, we were a little late to the party. We probably should have been doing this a lot sooner than we were. But the good news is, as of, you know, January of this year, we kicked things off and we're hitting the point where we're about ready to make the whole thing go live. So I would expect by the first or second week of June that website to be up and running.
Is that something you'd be interested in adding any layers to, or what are the total layers that would be on that data map, things like CRAs or other?
Yeah, so it's that part of it is still kind of a work in progress. I'll tell you the way we're thinking about it is kind of the initial map being a map of the state. And let's say you click on Weber County as an example. You go to the Weber County landing page. There's three zones in Weber County. You have the profile of each one. You have a county level prospectus talking about the types of things the county wants to see. Right, it's almost like a call for investment. If you're going to come to our opportunity zone, here's what we're working on. And then you'd have sample investments, right? You'd say, here is the Building X in historic downtown Ogden, ripe for redevelopment. We've already got a few projects that are live and going on that. And then you could at least use that to answer the question of what's happening in Utah and direct some of the investor interest that way. The layers, GoEd's IT team is the one that's driving this. I think we'd be very open to having your input on that and having dialogue with that when it gets to the point of that conversation. Right now, we're just trying to get the whole plan put together so that we can have something going. So again, happy to answer any questions. I think I'll pause there. I guess the one thing I'll say just in conclusion is the other piece of this that we're working on is how do we allow our county partners and our city partners to really stand out? So Utah was recently ranked the fourth most attractive opportunity zone market by a firm called Develop. It was founded by Steve Blickman, who was one of the founders of EIG. He left and started his own company after this legislation passed. In that, he ranked the top, I believe, 100 cities across the country for opportunity zone investments. And Salt Lake, again, was number four. Ogden, I believe, was number 14. So we have two in the top 15. And a lot of what we think some of these local jurisdictions should be considering is kind of what we're seeing as best practices across the country, which is providing clear communication and methodology to what the incentives are that you're using to attract the right type of investment. So the state of Maryland, as an example, put together like a $60 million statewide TIF fund. And in that announcement, they said, here's the types of things we want to see happening in Maryland. Affordable housing was a huge piece of it. Access to jobs that pay above a certain AMI was another one. And if you could come in and say, I read what you're looking for, I'm an investor who wants to do a project that really goes into the things you just highlighted, Maryland said, we'll make you eligible. We won't give you, but we'll make you eligible for our most favorable TIF treatment that we have on the books. So 80% participation for 20 years or whatever it is. And that caused a lot of investors to say, well, maybe I should go see what's happening in Maryland, right? Because there's a lot of these funds that are popping up taking capital gains from high net worth individuals and saying, we're going to go be a affordable housing fund. We're going to go build hospitality. We're going to go build high growth startups. And to the extent we can have our cities and counties and other organizations saying, this is what we want to see. These are the types of things we're looking for. I know Salt Lake, you guys have written a great prospectus already on the different corridors and the different areas that you want to see kind of be brought in, and I think that's phenomenal. That's the type of stuff we want to be seeing. And then making it so that when someone comes in to do a project, you've got the zoning and planning and the entitlements of the project really dialed in because of the time component that goes to this. And so we're working with a lot of our communities to try and say, how do we create almost the basket of incentives to bring the right types of investors, and how do you create the barriers so that the wrong types don't come up? Because as with anything, when there's a tax loophole, you're certainly going to have bad actors that are looking to come take advantage of this. And it's about making sure that you, as the gatekeepers, are creating both the carrots and sticks that either keep them in or keep them out. So that's a little bit about our project. Tried to sum up a longer presentation in a much shorter time period.
About no, we questions. Appreciate that. You have a question in the back.
That's the goal, right? So it's not live. So
can you repeat the question?
Oh, the question was, will the website highlight individual deals like the paper box loss, the one that happened in downtown Salt Lake? And the answer is yes. I mean, that's our intention, at least. The way we envision it is, if you click on the Salt Lake County map, Salt Lake County is going to be the hairiest of all of them because there's 15 zones across many different cities. But the idea would be that you would have kind of this real-time map of there'd be a dot that says paper box loss, learn more. You'd also have a dot that potentially might be paper box loss 6 months ago. And let's say they had an equity gap of $2 million. You'd have that living in real-time on the website. So that as you know, have components of investors out there looking, you say, why don't you take a look at the paper box project, right? Because that's the type of stuff, because of the touch points that Utah has, that's the type of stuff that getting. And in the role that Sorensen has and that I have from my background at the nationwide level, we definitely are getting people who are saying, I'm an affordable housing investor, what deals do you have in Utah that you can send my way? And not having a resource to send them to, candidly, is a little bit embarrassing, and it's something that I think we need as a state. And so I'm giving this as full credit to the governor's office for recognizing that and putting some money behind this to finally make it a reality. So they're working really hard at the GoEd side to get this up and running and get it live so that we have an answer to those types of questions.
Yes.
Maybe more of a statement than a question, but I think this is great what Patrick's been explaining about the need for cities and areas to be prepared. We see some very progressive cities who are recognize this as a very unique opportunity, for lack of a better word, opportunities open. And they have planning and zoning in place. They've recognized that we may have this once, you know, sort of in a generation opportunity to get what we want done in our city, what was previously not feasible, now is feasible. And they've been aggressive with getting the right plans in place. And they've been doing it by understanding the fiscal impacts to their city. So they're recognizing that, hey, we might be able to get a hotel here now, or we might be able to provide the right incentives to attract that type of development. So they're beginning to layer, you know, a CRA on an opportunity zone. They're understanding the impacts of the low-income housing tax credits and creating as many economic opportunities as they can in these zones in order to attract those dollars. They recognize that there is a time frame that while, you know, very correctly said that it doesn't expire this year, but the greatest benefits are hidden if they happen this year.
And there's a significant difference in the cities who are being proactive about this and those that are kind of waiting, sitting back for the market to react. Because this is the market. All of these economic development tools are key components of the market. And those cities that use them will be ultimately the ones that attract the most development. And so maybe it's just something to take back to some of your communities, but we're seeing remarkable differences from the cities who are being proactive about this and layering these tools. So.
I think that's extremely well said. And I think your point of saying this is the market is spot on. I think some of the cities that are sitting back are expecting there to be more formalized marketplace where everything kind of floats to the top, and that's just not the case, right? This is about taking, as you said, it's hard not to say the word opportunity when talking about this, but taking the opportunity yourselves and really standing out. And to the extent we can be a resource, the project that we're doing can help. We're here to help, and I'll make sure you all have my contact information. But I think that's a great point.
Patrick, besides the website, how are you getting out to the public sector, private sector?
It's a good question.
None of this works without them.
Yeah, so some of it is layered. So to give you an idea of what we see is it's kind of a, you know, when you get into particularly more rural counties, we have some investors and developers who we have relationships with who have said, hey, we're interested in projects that fit X, Y, or Z. You mentioned you may have one. It's down in Iron County. I don't invest in Iron County unless I have a local partner, right? And so it's about finding groups like the Levitt Group is an example down there to say, maybe we bring them in as a local partner that helps de-risk the investment to get it so that it's more attractive. Maybe it's trying to find other ways that we can bring the private sector here. A lot of it comes from the unique access that we have. Again, not to sound like a beating a dead horse up here, but Jim Sorensen was featured on the front page of Bloomberg today with his new fund. They're speaking at a big event in Newark tomorrow that EIG is hosting. I think Utah has a little bit of a unique lens on it where we have a chance to really go and say, you know, yeah, we have a cool website, but you should really be looking at Utah now. Let us know what it is that you want, and to the extent we have our cities ready.
How do we draw in our current private sector? Instead of just looking at outside Utah investment, how do we actually look at investment that can come within?
Oh, yeah. The one deal that's happened here is a local deal. Like, PEG is a local investor. And all of the large development companies and investors here are all thinking about this incentive. They're all aware of it. They're all looking at projects with this. We're talking to them on a pretty regular basis.
Awesome.
So we've got a sizable amount. I'd love to see it be localized. Sorry, I misunderstood your question.
No, no,
how do you get to the
totally
nation?
Fine. National both sides of it.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions for Patrick?
There's no other questions, but I do just want to note on page 35, we have a map that shows our Wasatch Choice 2050 vision areas, and then overlaid with that are the opportunity zones. And we don't have all of it put together yet, but on our website, there's going to be our Wasatch Choice 2050 vision, which links transportation and then locally selected land uses at different centers. And then overlay of opportunity zones will consider CRAs and potential TRZs and other areas in there to make one regional comprehensive sort of economic development existing conditions map. So hopefully that's helpful with your own local planning, considering the areas that you've already stated as centers or places that you want to consider market analysis, downtown plans, and then how those overlay with your opportunity zones as well.
Patrick, thank you. This was a great discussion. Appreciate your time. Okay, let's move on to item number 6, roundtable discussion. This is an opportunity, and I'm probably going to call on a lot of you, to tell us something good. What's going on in your communities? What would you like the rest of the group to know? What's happening that you want? Throw in the mix.
As you do that, can I just note that Joseph, Darren, and Blake joined us after
production, so they're going to talk now. They can introduce themselves as well. So I guess, and so Joseph.
You
got to
turn it on. There you go.
Okay, green light. All right, Joseph Spence. Obviously, I think I know quite a few of you. One thing this is announced that I've been working with the WFRC team here on is we're going to be hosting the Royal Family of Norway here next week on the 28th and 29th. Receive some invites to that effect.
It's on our upcoming events on the.
Yes. Is it down there? Or should I wait until then, or should I actually talk about it now?
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, so it's part of a larger program to really sort of get a lot of people that may pay more attention to Utah, some of the economic opportunities that are happening within Utah, more widespread notoriety, both throughout the United States and globally. And so there's a long list of people like Princess Martha Louise in that category that just through previous relationships that I have with them and my partners have with them that we, you know, enticed to come and spend some time with us here. And so as part of this program, we're going to be doing a broadcast out into the school system of leading innovators in particular spaces. So one being next generation STEM industries, other one being civic engagement, other entrepreneurship and creativity and learning. And so, you know, I'm fortunate enough to have had a relationship with the royal family of Norway for some time. And know that family. And so they agreed to come in to be an inaugural speaker for us here and to help sort of help more of the internationalize some of the things that are happening here within Salt Lake City and Utah more generally. And so first day, for example, the 28th and 29th, we're having a reception at the governor's mansion on the 28th. Then there will be a women's leadership dinner, which I believe everyone here should have gotten an invite for. Women, of course, have gotten an invite for. And if you have not, please highlight that to me, and we will correct the situation. But the wonderful, I don't know if you know Diane Stewart and her family, Samuel Spencer Stewart, Wasatch Advisors. They were gracious enough to sponsor that portion of the program and have it at their art gallery. So it should be a very well done event. There are a few other announcements that we will have for the 29th. As I mentioned, we will have the broadcast into the schools on the 29th, as well as the VIP dinner in association with the Governor's Energy Conference. You know, Norway is literally cutting edge when it comes to green energy. Now, I'm not sure how much you may know about Norway. They do have the world's largest sovereign wealth fund, and it's essentially oil money, right? But in recent years, they made a very significant pivot focused on sustainability, green technology in particular. They've been, you know, for years trying to reach out to engagement for them around these matters, and you know, this is the year that they're going to engage. And so that and many other events that we expect will come underneath this banner. You'll hear more about it. It's called, as I mentioned, Iconic Talks. We have leave to do at least one per quarter starting next year. And you'll see other notables within that category as well. When we come out to Utah, we will curate experiences around them that include a focus, like I said, on this 14 to 18 year old population to really kind of level them up on things that are going to happen and are changing our society in the next 5 or 10 years, mostly driven by technology and so on and so forth. And so we're really excited about it, and I hope that you all are excited about it and be able to engage this process as well. Last piece I'll highlight about that is, you know, one of the main things here, there are, you know, multiple family offices that I have relationships with that we're inviting out to partake in this event as well. Representing a couple of billion in additional capital that is potentially interested in doing additional deals here in Utah. The main purpose of these talks is to begin to catalyze projects and take, you know, dollars and themes, particularly things that have a very strong social impact in multiple counties, to galvanize the appropriate support to do those types of things. So, you know, with that, I mean, my contact information is openly available. Very happy to engage in conversation with anyone here around any of these items. As I mentioned, Salt Lake City, of course, is working on a biotech corridor. You know, one of those very strong relationships that we have in that area is Dr. J. Craig Venter. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, though, but he is the first person to sequence a human genome. You know, that human genome project literally was his gene that was used. Well, most people don't know he actually was born in Utah, for that matter. And you know, them and other people like them are very interested in coming here and doing business. Polarity TE, of course, was a great example of something that can be done within that biotech sector, and there are multiple others who would look at that example. And so I think WFRC has a wonderful role to play as a coordinator in a lot of these items, and so I'm happy to have them partner with me in doing these things.
So Joseph, if people are interested in this, they can either touch base with you or tell us, and then we can get the names to you.
Absolutely.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
Great. What else? Rick, what's going on at Salt Lake Community College? What's good?
Well, the West Point
excuse me, the West Point Workforce Training and Education Center over just east of the airport and backing up to 215. If you haven't been there, that's our newest location. We house 14 programs there, and I'd be very interested to find out, because of our energy management and solar program that's housed there, there would certainly be a tie-in with the Norway Royal family and possibly some of those projects. But we work very closely with industry. Just today, we launched a brand new aerospace assembly program for Boeing, Northrop Grumman, and Albany. That one kicked off first thing this morning. And so the one thing about Salt Lake Community College is while we have 10 locations, serve 60,000 students along the Wasatch Front, it's really important that the work that we do along our business lines, because of the diverse economy, that we're flexible and respond. And as companies come to us and ask for, they know we have this program and they have this program, but they really want this. And so it's the ability to have curriculum designers, developers, put those programs together and deliver. And so it's something that we work very closely with our partners to our north with Davis Tech, and then of course the other technical colleges as well. And we're all in this together. And so these industries, they span more than one county. I know I want to get up to speed with what this organization is doing. I'm very excited to represent Salt Lake Community College with this group. But we're excited with our new location. But of course, we're all over the Wasatch Front, and hopefully doing good things.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate it. Anyone else? Okay, we'll move on to Blake. What you got for us?
Lots of
Salt Lake County.
Sorry, Mayor Wilson can't be here. I'm pitching for Blake's office.
You're a great villain.
She hits with a higher batting average, but I'll suffice. So our county restructure is complete. We, as you know, it's Mayor Wilson. She brought on Catherine Cantor as the Deputy Mayor of Regional Operations. And then Mike Reber is her Associate Deputy Mayor. And I guess one thing I'll point out is we lost Patrick Mullen to UAC, but we have an opening. We reclassified it. That's what, because Patrick, you can't replace him.
So we ran the panel.
So that'll be out on the street soon. Last year we did a small business outreach effort where we interviewed over 500 small businesses throughout Salt Lake County and was marginalized, and we got a lot of great feedback about what was working, what isn't, and recommendations. All those findings are slco.org/business. And we even have it broken out by community and zip code. So it was a great little training data to be able to go through. And so we're following up. We had an event last year on June where we presented those findings. This year in September, we're going to be in West Jordan, the Vernon Library, and we're about to start next week in-depth focus group interviews with employees, because one of our big small business findings was workforce issues, right, availability, and turnover. And so we're going to do an employee kind of satisfaction type survey and see what they do and don't like about where they're at.
Even Walter's busy.
Yeah, we are. So we just renewed that. So we'll be doing that this year. And then sometime I'll let the group know, but in Q4, we're going to release a report on automation and the impacts of Salt Lake County's workforce. And we're exploring keynotes right now and haggling the price, and going to have hopefully a thought leader out here and release the report. So a few things on the horizon.
Great. Thanks very much. Yes, Darren.
This is the obligatory initial introduction.
Yeah.
So apologize for being late, but thank you. It's a pleasure to join you. Dave Heron, perhaps Davis Tech, calling from Kaysville. And Scott, congratulations on the sets. Well done. I'm glad to have joined in time to provide some comment to that. I appreciate you both very much. It's a job well done. Our contribution, I think, in large part, is the workforce development piece that continues to help feed the economic development engine. You're not familiar with Davis Tech and the college. We serve about 6,000 students across 36 high-demand programs, not granting any college credit, or degrees, but rather a laser focus on certificates. Some of those are industry defined, some of those the college provides. And so we serve about 6,000 students. As I mentioned, recently completed a study with Ken Barger Policy Institute that looked at our economic impact, and it was impressive, even for me, who had high hopes for the report. One of the things that I think is relevant is that 90% of our students, regardless of where they come from, and our home turf is Davis and Morgan counties, and we love serving the students, and most of our students come from those areas, but most of them stay. And so 90% of our students stay in along the Wasatch Front, or specifically Salt Lake County, Davis and Morgan and Weaver counties. And most of those, the lion's share of those, more than 50% in Davis and Morgan counties across those 36 programs that we provide. What is our strategy moving forward? I'm new in the job. I don't know how much longer I get to say that. It's still been under 6 months. But we've adopted some pretty aggressive goals for a county that isn't showing the growth, or, well, Morgan County is growing, as Ty would tell you. But Davis County isn't growing nearly as quickly. That said, we've set some pretty aggressive goals around workforce development. The first of which is we expect to grow our enrollments and our completers by 20% over the course of the next 3 years. And the other goals are equally important. We want to make a regional economic development contribution in terms of job creation of 10% over the next 10 years that we contribute to. So between the additional consumable power of those graduates, the wage increase and the value that they bring to the economy, and purchasing goods and services along the Wasatch Front because they're newfound wages, as well as our small business development. We host a very vigorous small business development center. We think that contribution will be significant. So that's part of our plan going forward, and I think it matches perfectly with this planning process and the plans that we've approved today. And that's why I was delighted that they overlap so well and we can provide comment to it. So
great.
Glad to be part. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks, sir. Appreciate that. We have time for one more. Andrew, I'm going to go to you. How did the season end up at Snow Basin?
Fantastic. No, we wrapped up a record season. You'll see some numbers released actually at Utah coming up the following week, but record ski visits across the state. We certainly benefited from that as well. So we had a fantastic winter. It's gonna lead right into our summer concert season, which is, if you've never been up to the resort, this is my shameless plug, so I apologize. This isn't,
it's awesome.
You're not taking my mic now. So free concerts every Sunday, some of the highlight acts this year, Dead Winter Carpenters, Andy Frasco, if you're like to a little rowdy, North Mississippi All-Stars, fantastic shows. Come on up, Blues and Brews on Sundays, Texas Barbecue, wonderful. That actually leads into our summer improvements. So we've got some major infrastructure projects happening across the resort that were funded by the record winter season. Snowmaking improvements, trail regrades to make the ski experience better for actually the lower level skier, which kicks off into our Learn and Earn program and season pass push that we'll be seeing forward. Learn and Earn program, if you're not familiar with it, is our award-winning national program in the state of Utah. So if you're not familiar with snow sports, success for if you try the sport for the first time is about 15%. Whether you take a lesson, whether you don't. If you're part of that program, we see 71% convert to a lifelong snow sport enthusiast. In fact, there's people at this table who were part of that program. So it's very, very well received. And then that program's on track for another record year as well as season pass push. So for us, we've had a fantastic 18 months, and as we move into Q3, it's moving fast.
Thanks for that. My kids are both in third year. Sorry, I appreciate that.
You know, Council Member Lang organized an EDD outing for fun. And I don't know, Andrew, I'm thinking maybe a summer concert EDD outing just for a little fun. What do you think?
We can certainly make that happen. That gives
some
space for
Sundays.
Us.
Sundays, is that okay?
Well, it's optional. So, yeah.
No, absolutely. Let's talk.
Awesome.
It's really fun. The shows are great.
Okay. Other business. Our next scheduled WFEDD meeting is August 26th. Again, same location, same time. Hopefully this time frame, we moved it back a half an hour. Is everyone good with giving you an extra half an hour to finish your lunch before you have to be here? Okay, perfect. And then we'll have a council meeting on May 23rd. looks like it's 2 days.
That's a full Wasatch Front Regional Council is meeting
yes.
this week, and that's the our organization that houses the DDE.
Yeah, I have to speak to them. Okay, yes.
And Abby and Gage Rohr, who's the Weber County Commissioner, who's the vice chair of the EDD, are going to present on the Comprehensive Economic Development Strategy to the full council. So,
okay.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
Well, I have one more announcement to make.
Other announcements. Other business. Go ahead. Oh, okay.
So it is now official that Abby Osborne, I think most of you know Abby personally. Abby is the vice president for government relations. Am I have that right? And public policy for the Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce, and has been an incredible advocate for our state, not just for the private sector, but also in collaboration with the public sector, and a great friend and partner. Abby is moving on to a new job. This was just announced on Twitter literally during this meeting.
My phone's blowing up.
Blowing up, and she stayed focused, which is really impressive during the meeting. Abby is going to be the chief of staff for the Utah House of Representatives, working with Speaker Brad Wilson. And those of you that know Abby, and those of you that know Brad, know that this is an impressive duo, putting those two together. So congratulations, Abby. But now Abby has said that if we'll keep her, then she is willing to continue on in her role as chair. So I'm looking around the table and seeing if anybody has any objections to that. You shouldn't.
You can talk.
Anyway, congratulations.
Thank you very much. Okay, with that, I will take a motion to adjourn.
Move second.
All in favor. Great.
I'm sorry, who moved?
Go for it. Second.
Good.
Thank you. It's the same.